hours later, returning a camper van to Auckland. A man and a woman pretending to be Swiss tourists. The police interrogated them all day, took them to a hotel that night and said, look, we're really sorry we arrested you. We're going to take you to the airport tomorrow. Use the phone, call room service, don't leave the room. They got on the phone, called up DSEG headquarters in Paris and said, hey, we did the job, but we'll be delayed a day. And then within hours, they found out that their passports were fake from Switzerland. So it was, and they went back into it.
So France claimed responsibility.
They admitted responsibility.
They paid compensation in the end, didn't they?
They paid compensation to us and New Zealand.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't trust.
They've
don't.
never apologized.
Hmm.
Well, 30th anniversary is a good time.
I'm not waiting for it.
Don't trust, don't fear, don't beg. We have 10 seconds. Why the title?
It's Neverna Boisi Naprosi, a Russian phrase that the prisoners were told when they arrived how to survive jail. So their fellow cellmates said, don't trust because... don't trust the prison officers, that's disrespecting yourself. Don't fear, because that gets you nowhere. Don't beg, because no one ever begged their way out of jail.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Don't trust, don't fear, don't beg. The extraordinary story of the Arctic 30 is by Ben Stewart, our guest. And thank you so much to Captain Peter Wilcox. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aramate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezdor, Amy Littlefield. I'm Nina Goodman with Aramate. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll ask, who are the Kurds and why isn't the U.S. supporting them?
KBOO is having a contingent in the Pride Parade, and we would love it if you would join us.
Please let us know if we can count on you to walk with us in the Pride Parade, Sunday, June 14th.
We will be meeting at 10 a.m. in the area around the North Park blocks.
Join us, wave at people, be fabulous, be KBOO.
The parade steps off promptly at 11, and all contingent members are to be together and ready by 10:30 a.m.
Please join us for a wonderful, fun, and lively day at the Pride Parade.
Call 503-231-803 and ask for Ani at extension 213 for more information.
KBOO Community Radio is accepting Toys for a Toy Drive conducted by McLaren's leadership in collaboration with McLaren Community Voice. The toys will be used during family visits for young family members visiting their loved ones in the McLaren Youth Authority. KBOO will have a barrel in their lobby from June 2nd to the 14th and will accept toys, stuffed animals in new or gently used condition. We will not turn down any donations. Your donations will be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The event will feature live music by Manda and the Latin Sound Trio, poetry by Alex Dang, Nepali dance performances and lessons, and more. Again, that's the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Demon. Okay, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This
Yes, it is.
And Abe's here, and this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. The number to call, 231-8187, Abe Proctor, Joe Uris. We're going to talk about the Kurds.
The Kurds. All right.
I have to say that I am... Of all the many, many ethnic communities and nationalist communities in the region that we have stumbled into and are about to be smashed by because we're stupid as a nation.
We didn't stumble.
No, we leaped.
That might be an argument for a different time.
Yeah, we leapt. We leapt eagerly. It's oil. Anyway, of all the peoples in that region, the Kurds, to my most romantic soul, seem the most interesting and perhaps the most progressive. So I think we should talk about the Kurds. We should talk about their role in the region. We should talk about Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Syria. And we should talk seriously about what's going on and who is who in that region. I am very distressed by the ignorance generally of people like myself. You know, many others, obviously, many, many others, about what is going on and why the hell we're doing what we're doing. Now, most of the audience of KBOO probably says, well, it's oil. And it is. But the history of that area is so important to our understanding of what's going on. I want to begin with a conversation very briefly about Turkey.
Okay.
Turkey was the center of the Ottoman Empire, which in World War I was part of the Central Powers that fought the Allies. The Allies were initially England and Russia and France, and then later the United States, and Russia had a revolution and dropped out. But during that period of time, the Ottoman Empire, which extended over much of North Africa and all of the Arabian Peninsula and Turkey itself and various other areas, collapsed and was replaced by a republican form of government, a modernized...
Small R Republican.
Pardon me?
Small R
Republican. Small R Republican. Yes, thank you. And was replaced by a government under a very powerful leadership of Kemal Atatürk. It was a government that converted, for example, the written form of the language from Arabic to Roman style.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially forbid most of the more exotic costumes in the regions, at least in the cities. It modernized the society as much as it could, and in the process of this, it oppressed, deeply oppressed, all of the ethnic minorities in the region. These minorities had been struggling for independence in the Ottoman Empire for years and years and years, and among them were the Kurds.
So just to summarize really quickly.
Yeah.
So in the post-Ottoman era, Turkey became a secularist, although a strongman-led government.
Yes.
Nonetheless, a secularist and Western-leaning one.
Yes, but also during that process, it committed genocide. Let's be clear about this. Mm-hmm. Genocide against a variety of peoples, most notably the
Armenians.
But others as well.
They have yet to admit to that fact.
Oh, yeah. They deny it.
Yeah.
And, well, we can say it's not true because they deny it. Well, come on. At any rate, Turkey today is part of NATO. It was brought into NATO during a period of time, first under the Truman Doctrine in 1947, when there was an effort to block Soviet advances in Turkey.
And what was the Truman Doctrine?
And Greece. The Truman Doctrine essentially poured lots of money and arms and so on into Greece and into Turkey to stop the spread of communism, that is to say, the Soviet impact in the region. And there was a terrible civil war in Greece, and somewhat of a civil war in Turkey. And the Truman Doctrine was successful in that it blocked the advance of a Soviet-style government in Greece and, of course, in Turkey. But this is important in another sense. Here is another example of what I call perfidious Albion, which is to say the lying behavior of Great Britain. Great Britain promised the Kurds, in order to get their loyalty during World War I, that they would create a Turkish, they would create a Kurdish state, and they didn't. You know, just like they promised to the Palestinians and to the Zionists the state of Palestine at the same time in that war to make sure that they had the support of the more powerful Jewish banking interests and others in World War I, and to make sure that they had support of independent pro-Arab, pan-Arabists in Palestine against the Ottomans. This is a pattern that's very important to understanding this whole region. And I just want to emphasize that because I don't want it to disappear in the folds of history, you know? You know what I mean? Okay, so the Kurds are an ancient people. They've been around for a long, long time. The history is so extensive, I'm not going to attempt to talk about the whole history of the Kurdish people. But in modern times, in our times, Kurds live in communities in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Turkey. And they had moved as a nationalist movement from a Maoist Marxist position to a democratic people's governmental form in modern, in recent, most recent times. They are now a kind of pro-socialist democratic organizational structure. And they are now engaged in fighting for their lives as a people. Remember that Saddam Hussein poison gassed the Kurds in northern Iraq.
Yes.
And that the Turkish government has...
Halabja.
Yeah. Very good.
Allegedly with chemical weapons manufactured in the United States.
Allegedly. Well, yeah. No, not even allegedly. We know.
Do we?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We are we are the providers. We and the Soviets and the French and others are the providers of the weapons which are used to kill people in that region. All kinds of weapons, chemical weapons, ordinary weapons, and so on. I have a list here.
Wait a minute now. I want to make sure I understand this correctly. You're implying that the major Western powers supply most of the world's weapons which are used to kill brown people.
Yeah, well, I don't want to just blame the Western powers. The Russians also and the Chinese also sell weapons or give weapons to these various forces. Okay. Why don't you and them fight and we'll give you weapons?
Oh, okay.
Kind of thing.
Okay. So one might be tempted to call that imperialist.
One might be tempted. One might be tempted, yes.
Okay.
But meanwhile, I became interested in the Kurds. I met a man in a... this is cool. You know, I met a man for coffee at a Lebanese restaurant, and we discussed this issue. All true. And he had spent quite a bit of time in Kurdistan, such as it is. And his arguments were eye-opening. And then when I began to really investigate, look into things, I discovered that most of what, if not all of what he was saying, was absolutely true. Here's some interesting things about the Kurdish people at this time. Their armies fight, as opposed to the Iraq army, which runs, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the Syrian government, which bombs and destroys. The Kurds fight. They have officers and regular troops who are women. They are a relatively progressive, socialist-oriented government.
Is that the measure of progressivism, that women are allowed to fight and die?
Well, unfortunately, the women are allowed to participate in all aspects of life in Kurdistan.
Well, that's
that includes fighting.
Good, I suppose. But of all the spheres of life that have been traditionally masculine, I would imagine that warfare would be the last one that women would be eager to join up. But maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say about that, except I'm not all for armed conflict. But no. The fact of the matter is that throughout that region, women occupy a position with very little power.
So you're saying this is progress of a sort?
It's progress of a sort.
Okay.
And I'm not going to certainly defend, oh, great, women get to fight and die. Well, that's not the point. The point is that women are given power. They're allowed to engage in the same struggles that the men do. Whether or not those struggles are a good thing in the ultimate sense of violence is irrelevant to the fact that women have more equality under the Kurdish system than they do under the Turkish system, under the Iraqi system, under the Syrian system, under the Iranian system.
So amongst Islamic countries, women enjoy a nearly unprecedented level of autonomy and self-determination.
Right.
And amongst the Kurds.
Right. And the level of struggle around the various issues of Sunni and Shia and so on are really kind of irrelevant in the struggles of the of these people. They are amazingly ethnically ethnically distinct from the Turks and so on. And by the way, the Kurdish parties in the most recent Turkish elections, which largely repudiated the Erdogan government, the Turkish representatives gained 13% of the vote and have for the first time gotten seats in the Turkish parliament.
Wow.
So here's the question that I'm raising, and I would love to hear from people who know more about this than I. 231-8187. Here's the thing. Why, and I'm going to answer the question, I'm going to ask it, and then I'm going to answer it, and then I'm going to let other people call us and talk about it.
Okay.
Why is it that the United States has so involved itself since 1952 with Turkey, a nominal democracy, which has always been, as I say, nominal in its democratic policies, and involved itself with a dubious Iraqi government, which we created and is collapsing all the time, and with Iran, interestingly enough, which has separated itself from the West very clearly since 1979. Why is it that we do not directly support the Kurds, who are the only effective fighting force against ISIS?
Ooh, I know.
What's the answer?
Oil.
Oil?
Oil.
Now
yes, why do we involve ourselves with those other nations? The answer is oil.
But the Kurds would give us oil.
Yes, I'm sure they would. But right now the Kurds are spread across four or more nation states.
Oh, more.
Each of which is a supplier of a substantial amount of oil to the United States, with the exception possibly of Iran.
Potential.
So, yeah, that's the answer. You say, well, the Kurds might give us oil. Well, the oil that the Kurds are living on top of was technically part of these other nation states with whom we have arrangements already.
Okay, here's the only solution that I see to the situation in Iraq at this time. The situation can only be resolved by the creation of three nation states out of Iraq. This is not something that had to happen, but it's something due to the United States' incredible stupidity of invading Iraq twice and getting engaged and stuck in what's going to be forever war. The only solution is to create three nations: a northern Kurdish nation state, a western side of it as a Sunni state, and the eastern side as a Shia state. It's the only solution.
What about the alliance with Turkey? I see that causing a big problem.
Well, yeah, it kind of does.
But millions of Kurds who live in Turkey would quite naturally say, well, I'd like to be part of this nation in northern Iraq that is now Kurdish. Turkey would just hand off a chunk of its sovereign territory to this new nation because we asked them to?
I'm laughing because, yes, you're right.
Okay.
But I don't see any other path for peace in the region at this point.
Man, this is a mess.
Yeah.
It's such a mess that we couldn't even fix it if we wanted to.
No.
It's such a mess that nobody might be able to fix it if they wanted to.
Well, I think it's fixable, but I think it takes some incredible degree of insight and creative thinking, none of which the government of the United States at this time seems capable.
Well, let me follow up on your earlier questions that you asked. Why don't we support the Kurds?
Yeah.
You might say that ideologically and historically, the Kurds have a lot in common with the United States, which was itself founded as a revolutionary state.
Yeah.
Founded out of violent rebellion against its colonial masters.
Mm-hmm.
You might see a lot of parallels between the United States and the Kurds. But if that were the only criterion for United States intervention, we'd be propping up people all over the world. But we don't do that. We tend to get involved only when we have an economic interest at stake.
Well, I agree with you about that. But I also think there's another aspect. The Kurds, historically in modern times, moved to the left and were, in fact, supporters of a kind of Maoist policy. Mm-hmm. That they have abandoned. They're now a democratic socialist. They now have a democratic socialist position, which means they believe in democracy and voting and so on. But we have always regarded them as a part of the terrorist networks of the world. We say, and is very possibly true, that they finance their activities through drug movement. But, of course, so do many, many, many forces in the region.
So does the United States, so does, historically.
Yeah. Well, so do a lot of people, unfortunately, or fortunately. Anyway, I raise this question, and I wonder if people are not interested in talking about a possible solution to what is now an endless and impossibly evil war in Iraq. And, you know, it's just, it occurs to me, you know, here's a relatively progressive people who have been willing to stand up and fight against ISIS, as opposed to the Iraqis, who the Iraqi official government, which is largely Shia, which is always at potential war with its Sunni, what was until we invaded the region, a Sunni-dominated totalitarian regime under Saddam Hussein. Now, that stable government is gone. The Shia-ish kind of government that exists there is not capable of raising and holding together an army. I mean, the last time the ISIS people moved against the Iraqis, the Iraqi army ran away. This was after we'd supposedly trained them to fight.
Right, but also after we disbanded the Iraqi army. The officers of which went on to form the backbone of ISIS.
That's
true.
It
must be observed. Boy, we made a mess.
We made a mess.
You know, it's really hard to get your brain around what a huge mess it is in Iraq now.
Yeah.
And by extension, in the vicinity.
Well,
and that we have really yet to come to terms in this country. We've really yet to make a moral reckoning with the abyss that is the war and occupation of Iraq.
Yeah.
What a mess.
And in a larger sense, how Western powers messed over that whole region, largely for oil, but, you know, for territorial gain. In fact, I mentioned earlier, but I want to emphasize it, the situation in Palestine / Israel is directly a result of promises being made to the Zionist Jewish nationalists and to the Palestinians by the British during World War I so that they could defeat the Ottoman Empire.
All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call to join this conversation. If you don't want to talk on the phone, you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/Abe and Joe. All right, I got two questions for you.
Okay.
We just talked about what a huge, huge mess Iraq and vicinity are. So what do you say to the typical justification you hear from Americans on this? Oh, Saddam Hussein was an evil, brutal dictator, gassed his own people. The world is better off without him. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't think the world's better off without him purely because he held together through his terroristic techniques the whole region and kept it relatively suppressed and quiet.
But he was an evil dictator who gassed his own people.
Yes.
Freedom.
No. Not okay. Our business.
All right, question number two. Let's presume for a moment that out of a reverence for our deeply cherished democratic values as a nation, we decided to involve ourselves and support the Kurds economically and militarily. What happens then?
Well, the only real advantage that brings directly is that you get a fighting force with well-equipped
arms. Right, because the world needs more of those, particularly the Middle East.
Yeah, I'm not going to defend that position.
All right, well, let me put the question a different way. Should we support the Kurds militarily and economically beyond the level we do already?
The answer is I think so.
Why?
Because they will fight.
Why is that good?
Well,
they will fight ISIS?
They will fight ISIS.
And we have an interest in that happening?
As long as we're there. Now, if we withdrew, If we said the hell with it and walked away, that'd be a lot of ugly ethnic cleansing and religious-based cleansing, and it would be dreadful, and who knows what would come out of that.
One could argue that's happening already.
It's close to that.
Okay. So you would advocate then arming and giving a bunch of money to the Kurds so that we can get out of there and let them fight ISIS.
You make me feel really bad. If I say yes, it's bad. If I say no, it's bad.
I'm trying to get to the reality of the Gordian knot that is Iraq, the enormous mess.
Well, as I said earlier, the only answer I can see is dividing Iraq into three nation states, one Kurdish in the north, to the west, a Sunni nation, and to the east, a Shia nation.
Right.
That's the only solution I can imagine.
Because religious partitions have a long and glorious history of success. Look at India and Pakistan. That's really worked out.
Well, yeah.
Look at Ireland and Northern Ireland. That was a brilliant, brilliant solution.
Yes. Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Who do we have next? First, Bob, good morning.
Good morning. This is Bob, the guy that you met in the Lebanese restaurant.
Hi, man. How are you?
How are you today?
I'm good. Right. You know more about this than I do. Talk.
Well, I was just there. I came back 2 weeks ago. I was there because the Turkish elections were about to be held. You know that last Friday there was a terrorist bombing in Ahmed or Diyarbakir, in which four of our people were killed and 350 wounded. But there was also massive pressure brought against the People's Democratic Party in Turkey, but we still broke the 10% threshold. We entered parliament with 13% of the vote. It's not enough, perhaps, to take the offensive in parliament, but it is enough to cause a realignment in Turkey and in the government. And by extension, I think, through the region. It also probably means early elections in Turkey in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this has a very positive effect, potentially, on the region. It's just a tremendous victory, given the terrorist attacks and the coordinated institutional attack on the People's Democratic Party that we won, and won by so big. I don't know that anyone's got a solution to what's going on in Iraq or Syria. I would say that a point you made earlier was really good and very important, that ISIS has been beaten only by people fighting on the ground who are inspired by an ideal. The Peshmerga from the Kurdistan Regional Government left Sinjar or Shengal at a very key moment, ran away. They've had some bad strategy because they're not based in the people, whereas in Rojava we've defeated ISIS. And we're going to keep defeating ISIS. Rojava is not contiguous, but the liberation movement is within 6 miles of Tel Abad this morning. And if Tel Abad can be taken, the entrance for ISIS from Turkey gets shut down effectively, and the cantons begin to become contiguous.
So you're saying a nation state is being aborning in this process. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think it's something much better than a nation state. I think the ideas of democratic confederalism developed by Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, who is in prison in Turkey, are a step beyond a nation state. The idea that people could remain in Rojava in a democratic Syria and people could remain in a democratic Turkey, but in North Kurdistan, and affiliate across false international borders with one another and hopefully and eventually with our people in Iran and Iraq is something beyond a nation state. It's something more democratic. It's something more realistic. And it allows for new kinds of internationalism that we haven't seen. I think Abdullah Öcalan has done great work in dispensing with the idea that the nation state is the solution to things, especially in the Mesopotamian region.
Well,
it has a very different history than Europe.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. I mean, I'm thinking about the Kurds as in ethnic enclaves in places like Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. and elsewhere, and their long history of getting pushed around and fighting all throughout, I mean, throughout the known history of that region of Mesopotamia. And what you're suggesting, though, is a kind of a new vision that is not nation states with the 20th century borders, but rather national interests, ethnic interests, which are expressed in some other form, some other political form. Is that where you're going with this?
Yeah, we can do better. We can sure do better. The other piece that I had that worries me here is that the demand for a nation state falls into the hands of Barzani in Iraq, intentionally or unintentionally. He would love to see a nation state. He's a corrupt Kurdish leader. He has very good relations with the Turkish government and not with the Kurdish liberation movement. And for him, a state is the solution because he can see himself or his family and his party being in charge. And I think that that causes an internal conflict in the Kurds. What we're demanding is a national congress of Kurdish forces to sort this out. And until that congress can get held, we're left speaking from factions and groups and positions. The problem is where this congress could be held under conditions of war and conflict. And the other problem is where could it be held safely for security reasons, right?
Yes.
So I don't have a solution to those problems. I do want to say, since you mentioned Iraq a lot, we really need to support the Yazidis in Shingal and Sinjar, especially those Yazidis who are working with the liberation movement and have formed their own organizations. There's a kind of internal conflict among the Kurds about where Shingal or Sinjar belong, and what the future for that is. We need a humanitarian... The problem of arms and going into arms going into the region troubles me as it troubles you. I'm finally, at the end of the day, okay with the coalition bombing, and if it's done in coordination with the liberation movement. But I think we can all agree on the need for a humanitarian corridor into Rojava and the need for international support to rebuild Kobane. At the very least, I think we can agree on that.
Now, just by way of background, there's a not insubstantial chunk of northern Iraq that has, for all intents and purposes, been functionally independent from the central Iraqi government for some time, even going back to the no-fly zones established in the 90s. Is that right?
Well, you're talking about the KRG?
Yes.
Yeah, where Barzani lives.
Barzani lives. But he is not a trustworthy figure, you're saying?
Well, I think he's corrupt. I think he's been corrupted by oil money. I think he and his party have managed to make the KRG a they're focusing just on oil and not on other forms of development, and that has a shelf life, of course.
Of course,
he's engaged in a fight with Baghdad, and he's choosing between Baghdad and Turkey, and he seems to be choosing Turkey. He supported Erdogan during the elections. They're part of the embargo against revolutionary Rojava, there are better forces in the KRG to choose from than Barzani, but he's the guy in charge.
This is interesting. I just was looking at some material about the Yazidis, who are a Kurdish-speaking people, who were the only people that saved them from total destruction from ISIS were the Kurds.
Yeah, I was in a Yazidi refugee camp when I was over on my last trip that I just came back from. There's some very interesting things. The Yazidis are really very peaceful people who were taken by surprise. They had no means of defending themselves because they really are very culturally anti-war. These people walked for weeks in large groups into Turkey, entered Turkey illegally through Roboski, and live in these camps now. The camps are divided between government-sponsored camps in Turkey that are just miserable, terrible places, and places that are provided by the radical or progressive municipalities, which are much nicer and much easier. The women's movement in those camps is incredibly strong. The feminist movement is incredibly strong in those camps. And there's been some success in recruiting people to go back and fight, but I would say that most of those people want to move to Europe and assimilate, despite what their spiritual leaders or their community leaders and the liberation movement would like. Their focus is on Europe, and Europe has shut the door in their faces. So there's kind of a crisis there.
Is there a role in all of this of Islam in either the Shia or Sunni dimension?
Well, so you know from meeting me that I dress in what might be called traditional Sunni clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to change my clothes before I went into the camps because of the distrust of Muslims and Arabs particularly. Hmm. The Yazidis feel that they were betrayed by their Arab neighbors. And that's not completely wrong. On the other hand, in Rojava, the area that's between the cantons is Arab majority.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Arab fighting forces taking the side of the liberation movement there. 41 people just graduated from one of the liberation movement's fighting academies last week. And there are dialogues with the Arab tribes there. I also want to say Rojava is majority Kurd, except for one of the enclaves, which is split between Kurds and Assyrians, and that there are three languages used in Rojava by law: Arabic, Kurdish, and Assyrian. So I don't want to give the impression that this is just a Kurdish issue.
I think that really is important. I also think when you mention the Assyrians, my mind is boggled because I think of the Assyrians as a mighty power of biblical times.
Yes, right. Chariots and all that.
Right. I think we all do here in the United States. But there's an Assyrian renaissance taking place across the region in Turkey. Many some Assyrians were elected on Sunday to the parliament. Four Christians were elected in Turkey, which is really a big deal. Two of them come out of the radical party. A gay Armenian was elected as well, which is also kind of earth-shaking in Turkey. This is an aside. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get off topic.
Yeah, it's kind of my fault.
You asked about the Shia.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Certainly Kurds are divided by religion. There are huge numbers of Alevis. There are people who are atheists and agnostics. There are Muslims, Shia and Sunni. There are Yazidis. There are Zoroastrians. There are Christians also. And there is an expatriate community of Kurdish Jews. The first woman rabbi was a Kurd. We need to keep that in mind.
And there's a not insignificant Kurdish diaspora in lots of places.
Yeah, in the United States, it's mostly... It's mostly people from Iraq and Iran, but I want to give a shout-out to the great work that the Kurds from Turkey did in the elections, getting out the expatriate vote in the United States. That vote went mostly to the Liberal Party in Turkey, but the progressive Kurdish community in Chicago did a great job in getting votes for the HDP as well.
See, now, I have to say, as we talk of this, I realize... I don't know for sure, but I realize that most Americans and probably most of our audience have no idea of any of this. We bask in an ignorance and a naivete that ends up supporting a weird colonial policy by the United States.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is about oil, of course.
It's true. Rojava is trying to develop without oil. Only one of the enclaves has oil. The oil issue is more for people in Iraq than in Rojava, and I think our attention should be on Rojava as much as Iraq.
Where's Rojava? Help us.
Rojava is part of northern Syria. It's within the confines of northern Syria on the Turkish border.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there. Kobane is embattled. Kobane, 280 straight days, I think, or more of fighting. Oof. Much of it hand-to-hand for liberation. Kobane has been flattened in the fighting, and people still fight every day and build a life there. It's our generation's Stalingrad in many ways.
Wow.
So in the context of the Kurdish liberation movement, what, in your opinion, would be an appropriate course of action for the United States to take?
Well, I know we'll disagree about this, but I'm okay with the bombings, U.S. coalition-led bombings, if they're done in coordination with the liberation movement, because I trust the liberation movement not to bomb civilians. ISIS can't be negotiated with. There's nothing to negotiate with fascists. Certainly, though, we could agree on a humanitarian corridor that needs to go from Turkey into Shengal and Sinjar, and a humanitarian corridor going into Rojava. We need to stop the embargo against Rojava. There needs to be an international conference to rebuild Kobane. When that happens, the refugee crisis in Turkey will lessen and political conditions there will improve. I'm wary of U.S. support for the Kurds. You mentioned Halabja before. That happened in part because the Kurds trusted the United States. Thank you for mentioning Halabja. It isn't mentioned enough. Mm-hmm. But there needs to be some support, I would hope, from the people of the United States, for the People's Democratic Party in Turkey. I'd be wary of government support for the HDP, but we should support the People's Democratic Party in Turkey. They have an ambitious agenda ahead of them. That's my kind of thumbnail answer to your question. If I may, can I do a plug? Is that okay?
Yeah, do a plug.
We do a blog every day on what's happening in Kurdistan and Turkey. We try to keep it simple because, as you say so well, Americans have a very distorted image of what's going on there. The blog is at turkeyharvest.blogspot.com.
Turkey Harvest?
People are going to think that's a Thanksgiving website.
Yes, it is. I know. People do think that. Harvest is the name of a long-standing political journal in Turkey. So it's turkeyharvest.blogspot.com. We follow very closely, and from the inside, the liberation movement. We hear from those folks every day and publish what we think is reasonable from them and from some others.
So one more question before we let you go. Yeah. Do you foresee the Kurdish liberation movement eventually coalescing into an independent nation state for the Kurds?
I think there's two parts of that answer. One is the really beautiful, poetic part of it that Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned leader of the Kurdish liberation movement, can walk out of prison and into parliament. That's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. Even the fascist party in Turkey says that that's possible. It's something I didn't think I would live to see in my lifetime, but it's possible. The other thing is the second part of that answer is I think that if the Kurdish liberation movement, or if the Kurdish people rather, are able to hold a national congress, I think we end up with something much better and something far beyond a nation state. I think particularly we need to pay attention to what the Kurds in Iran are doing. Several weeks ago, there was a horrific sexual assault in Mahabad, the traditional seat of Kurdish revolutionary movement in Iran. This sparked an uprising there, which the guerrilla movement took part in. There's been an intense revival of revolutionary consciousness in the Mahabad region in Iran. So even those over the last 2 years, so even those folks should participate. Their leadership is in Kandil, the liberated area where the political leadership is now. So there's great opportunities.
Well, this is, we're opening the door, which I consciously and kind of deliberately did here, to creating some awareness and perhaps even some intelligent discussion of the actual situation of a people that are kind of either dismissed or marginalized in American consciousness. And I want to thank you, first of all, for bringing this all to my attention months ago. And I also want to make clear that most people in America just aren't even able to get wrap their minds around any of this. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you for your good effort, really. Thank you for helping to keep the issue alive, really, on behalf of the movement. Thank you.
Thank you for your perspective.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And I also, I have to acknowledge a kind of almost naive romanticism around what actually Abe pointed out to me as a contradiction. I am so impressed with the Kurds' willingness to fight and to die, and the fact that women are both officers and regular troops, and the Kurds seem to relate to women as equals. This is unprecedented in the region.
Well, yeah, it's true. I think it's, you know, if you need if you're having a dark day and you need optimism, turn to Kurdistan. Go to our blog. There's just reason for optimism. It's a great future ahead of us. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. You can also listen on one of the internet tubes, the one that leads to your house. That's www.kboo.fm. If you want to leave a comment on our Facebook page, you can do that at facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Have I spouted off enough information?
Well, you can't.
No, I have not.
No, you need to do more. More information.
At 9, coming up today on KBOO, at 9 on Alternative Radio, hear Naomi Klein talk about atmospheric consequences. She is awesome.
Ah, Naomi Klein. Oh, she's so good.
Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. Her articles appear in major newspapers and magazines all over the world. She is the author of the bestsellers No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, and This Changes Everything.
Which is about climate.
Right. Shock Doctrine is about how capitalism works in the modern age.
Yeah.
Or actually for a long time now. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, local news hosted by Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D. May Roberts features Outright Theater Festival with artistic director Rusty Tennant, who is directing the world premiere of the musical Under the Influence. The festival celebrates LGBTQ contribution to theater while also serving as an incubator for developing work by or about the LGBTQ community. Other guests include Under the Influence's Ernie LaJoie, composer Kevin Lorson, and Jack Stocklin, who is directing They, Them, There by Lila Janelle. At 11:30, we'll hear an episode of Book Waves, hosted by Richard Volinsky. His guest is Carrie Perloff, the artistic director of American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. She discusses her memoir, Beautiful Chaos, A Life in the Theater, and talks about the role of nonprofit theater in America today. All that and more coming up today on your community-supported radio station, KBOO. And may I point out that right there, just in the next couple of hours, is an incredible diversity of programming.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that this, I'm not pleased to say this because there should be more of this, but this show today is, as far as I know, the only discussion of the situation of the Kurds and Kurdish struggles for nationhood and so on that is taking place anywhere in media in the United States. I mean,
yeah,
think on that.
It's true.
We want to hear from you. 231-8187.
George, you're next. Good morning.
Morning, and thank you for this outstanding conversation with an exceptional commentator that we just wound up. One of the things I hear sometimes, I hear it all the time, when we people of this country start talking about what we are supposed to do, we use this word we. And Herbert Aptheker, one of the old communists from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, who did a lot of history, noted that this was one of those necessary things that we use in conversation, we. And he was pointing to the fact that, well, we aren't really we. We are, for the most part, on KABU, we are the 99%, or we are the other part, that the other 1% or whatever percent it is wants to rule. And I think one of the things to do when discussing these things is to remember that we, this country, is really part of NATO, and NATO represents most of what this country does. And I think that the federal government and its military and intelligence agencies are really very well integrated into this, I'd call it a criminal terrorist organization. I call it the North Atlantic Terrorist Organization. It has no respect for human rights, and it consists of one assault on one country after another. And so listening to this last conversation, I began to think this is what we, or those of us in this country who don't want to be part of imperialist murder in the Middle East and elsewhere, we can listen to those of us who are realize that we don't want to be part of NATO's career of mass murder. We can listen to these outstanding commentators like this last guest, and we can listen to all those who point out to us that Shia and Sunni in many countries in the Middle East for centuries learned to live together peacefully, and along came NATO and did what it does so well. It created hatreds, and it did false flag operations, blowing up a famous mosque, I believe, in Iraq. All this was done to split up people and make the country vulnerable to U.S. further U.S. penetration to control the resources. And so I'd say let's listen to people like this last guest and another one who doesn't get much mention, but he has done outstanding investigation into the role of U.S. and Western intelligence all over the region. And he has several great books out. And his name is Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, and he operates out of Brighton, England, where he's a human rights researcher. And one of his most fascinating books is The War on Truth, where he talks about the role of Western intelligence in fomenting and keeping going massacres of innocent, normal Muslim villagers in Algeria and terrorism all over the region. So if we want to understand what we can do to help the Kurdish people, I'd say let's listen to people who are scholarly and well-informed investigators and ordinary folks from these regions, and let's try to keep our country, I don't know how we're going to do it, from continuing this war of terror that NATO does all over the place.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the role of NATO. I talked about it a little bit earlier, but it's really important to understand, just looking at the geopolitical situation right now, that at the end of, at the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was an agreement made between the then Soviet government and NATO that countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia and the Ukraine and so on would be demilitarized. That is, they would not be part of either camp. That agreement was never kept. The most immediate and obvious thing that most people know, that our listeners probably know, is that the United States put missile bases in Poland and other countries allegedly to control the dangers of the allegedly dangerous Iranians. In the process of that, anyone in Russia would read that as, wow, these are missiles suddenly installed right on our border with capability. Yeah, they can hit Iran, but they can also hit Moscow or St. Petersburg. So the response of what I consider to be a fascist government in Russia today is not unreasonable. I'm not justifying it, but it's not unreasonable as a response to a perception that suddenly, from what was a relatively secure position, Russian homeland faces a graver danger than ever before. And this allows a character like Putin to become an incredibly powerful figure, resorting to all of the old traditional reactionary nationalist ideas, including religious ones, and essentially repressing homosexuality, repressing freedom of discussion, repressing any amount, anything you could name in the way of democratic processes. And that is directly part of what has happened with NATO's aggressive policies. Anyway, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you so much, Joe and Abe.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, and hey, listen, if you disagree with us, which is cool, we would love to hear from you, or if you agree, or if you have new material to add.
No, I just want to hear positive reinforcement.
Oh, you're so silly.
Only call if you're prepared to kiss our backsides. That's
no,
all
no,
I want
no,
to hear.
No. We want to hear from people who say, you know, you guys are just crazy.
I'm glad he brought up the NATO angle.
Yeah.
I mean, that's talk about an alliance that has outdated itself and hamstrings any thoughtful action in that area. And why is Turkey a member of NATO when it's nowhere near the North Atlantic?
It's a member of NATO because it constituted a bulwark beginning in 1947 against the spread of Soviet-style communism.
Right. The Soviet-style communism is gone, along with the Soviet Union, is it not?
Yeah,
so why do we need the North Atlantic Treaty Organization anymore?
Well, we've repositioned it to control the outrages of Russia.
Wouldn't it be better and run with me a little bit on this. Wouldn't it be better if instead of forming organizations like NATO, or instead of forming nominal coalitions for military intervention like the United States does, wouldn't it be better if we trained and equipped an army of blue-helmeted UN soldiers that could go into places and do things like suppress genocides or supervise free elections, things like that.
Or a military force, clean water supply.
Oh, sure.
Decent sanitation.
A military slash civilian force that is unaligned with any one nation or group of nations. Wouldn't that be a better way to deal with these sorts of problems?
Maybe, but I'm almost in favor of our withdrawing from military alliances, period. I think we've reached the point where we're destroying the world, we're destroying the environment, we're doing it all in the name of a capitalism that serves fewer and fewer people in this country or elsewhere.
I'm with you there.
Anyway, we got callers.
But I'm wondering, though, to the extent to which a world police force, I'm using air quotes there, is necessary, and I realize that's a debatable point, wouldn't it be better to have one under the auspices of an international body?
Well, I suppose if you got to have a world police force, yeah, the blue helmets are better.
Yeah.
But I would point out that it was the blue helmets that went into Haiti from Nepal, of all places, and ended up giving everybody a horrible, horrible disease.
Well, yes. Unintended consequences, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. All right, let's hear
from
you.
Let's go for the phones.
231-8187. Who is it? Perry, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier you were mentioning about the Armenians. Mm-hmm. Well, after World War One, there was a war crimes trial. Two of the Turkish leaders were put on trial, and they were convicted of these war crimes against the Armenians, and they were given the death penalty in abstention. And later on, both leaders were assassinated by Jewish extremists.
Hmm. I don't know anything about this.
Oh, yeah, and it's part of history, so and why they're bringing this Armenian stuff up here in the United States is there's people in Armenia are looking for a greater Armenia. So they want to destabilize Turkey so they can grab some of their ancient homeland.
Are you denying that the Armenian genocide happened?
Oh, it did happen, just that people have to realize that these were the two leaders, only two leaders of World War One that were executed for war, you know.
Huh. Well, that is interesting. I don't know a thing about that, so I can only say, hey, that's interesting.
Yeah, but that's okay. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, see, once we dip into these issues, once we look at the whole region, when I say the whole region, I include the western part of Russia. I include the European powers. I include North Africa and the terrible struggles going on there, and all of the Middle East and the blunder of the United States under the Bushes and Dick Cheney that have led us into a disastrous situation in the Mideast. Once I start looking at these things, I rip the cover, without even intending to, off of a lot of stuff that most Americans, myself included, don't really appreciate or understand adequately. So I want to urge people to start, just go on the internet, start looking around. You're going to be amazed at the historical injustices and horrors that were were dumped on these regions, largely by the Western powers in their struggles over control of resources.
And remember that everything you find on the internet is true.
No!
So there's really no need to read critically use a filter of any kind.
No. You shouldn't say that even as a joke. But you do get insights and you do find stuff out. And I really think, I'm pleased that we did this show.
I am too.
I think we really need to open the door on the situation of the Kurdish people, whose situation politically, with two rival factions, really, in the Kurdish nation's national interests, really is important and can really be a significant factor in getting us out of and creating more justice for the people of Mesopotamia.
Well, I don't know that I'd necessarily agree with that. But it does certainly bear some investigation. And I think all of us as citizens of the United States owe it to ourselves and to the people of this region whose lives we have so profoundly screwed up to get as much of our brains around the situation as possible. And that includes an assessment of the Kurdish situation.
Yeah, and I really want to express appreciation for our call-in guest, who is very much a supporter of the Kurdish left. And I want to also remind everyone that we at KBOO do this. We do this.
Yeah, we do.
Because nobody else will.
It's true.
So stay tuned for some more amazing information on KBOO and the greatest music in the land.
All right. And you're off for a couple weeks, right? It'll just be me. I'll be back next week.
Yeah. And you'll be having fun.
I'll be having fun.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. Square.
It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School Series, titled Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Classes will be Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift in Portland. The first class, June 10th, will focus on the context for urban natives of Portland. Current studies estimate at least 60% of Native people live off-reservation. Historically, this is no accident. Discover why it's important to understand the unique characteristics of urban Indians compared to other non-white urban populations and to their reservation counterparts. Again, that's Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9.